Dr. Finley, we did a good show with you on Life on the Rock about your new book, Sexual Identity, and the harmony of philosophy, science, and religion?
Revelation. Pretty close to the same.
But I wanted to just talk about your specialty is philosophy, but I also want to talk about that opening chapter a little bit more. You have these great summary statements at the end of the chapter, like what men and women mean to us. And you write that it's a primary element of our human experience, you know, biologically and personally and historically. You know, we depend on it for our existence. But I was trying to grasp that in the show. It's such a gift, right? We're kind of situating this in the transgender movement, right, as an answer to this whole thing. And we're missing, like, I feel like the greatness of God's creation here. And I think this chapter kind of speaks of that and its significance, doesn't it?
Yeah, that was the hope. That was my attempt. One way of helping people buy into something true or see something true is simply by redescribing realities that are fairly familiar to us already, but just articulating them in a kind of compelling way and with some thought.
Right.
You don't have to have complicated proofs or demonstrations.
Yeah.
Right. You're reminding people, recalling them to a reality that they already in some way know. The master of this is Chesterton. Mm-hmm. And so what you were just saying reminded me of some of the things he says about family life. Mm-hmm. Right. When you talk about this gift that we are as men and women, and that we're losing sight of that. Well, for most people, family life is the source of their great joys, right? It's also the source of their great challenges, but it's the source of what's most real for them. And most people would tell you that if they went to the grave and the family members they left behind detested them, then no matter what else they had accomplished, they'd be a failure.
Right.
Despite the fact that in their working days, they might have in fact devoted the vast majority of their time not to their family. But that, to me, that's just an indication of the fact that this humble reality of the man-woman structure of human nature and our relationship is at the heart of who and what we are. And there are forces, both ideological and materialistic and technological, that are swiftly abstracting us from these concrete realities.
Right.
They prey on us on a daily basis.
Yeah, it seems like it's the one big distraction that God doesn't, or not God, but the evil one doesn't want us to look over here or pay attention to the essentials of life, you know? He's always like distracting us. And in our culture, it's just like it's with the technology, with the media, it's going to be so dazzling. And, you know, it's like Eve looking at the fruit, saying it's beautiful to behold, you know. But the real beauty, and I feel like that as a preacher and trying to teach the faith at times, it's like I feel like my job is to show why this is beautiful, why this is true, why this is good for us, right? And all of creation is like that. I've come to appreciate that more the last few years, doing a little bit of research, reading, but I've always loved the outdoors as a Boy Scout, active. But, you know, I get here, I join the Franciscan community, they're talking about nature all the time, and I feel like I'm not getting out of it what St. Francis is talking about, right? But, you know, finally, I just started to pay attention to the simpler things. I always thought it had to be sort of big and powerful and that, like the California coast or something, right? Well, I'm in Alabama, right? We don't have the California coast. But if you pay attention to even the small things, the simple things, there's beauty all around us. And what I've come to realize, too, is that this is God's first book to us, a revelation. And this nature is like going to bless us because it comes from his hands for us to nurture us, to bless us in some way. How much more is marriage and family, right?
That's a really nice way to put it.
Yeah.
I think that at least for myself, when you talk about that engagement with nature, sometimes it can be simply paying attention, a reflective or contemplative moment. A lot of the times, and I'm thinking especially in conjunction with my kids, it involves something that involves nature pressing back on us a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. So going for maybe a challenging hike with mm-hmm. my son, or getting them out in the ocean where you've got to be impacted by what nature is, but somehow you come away feeling more yourself, but also with a deeper appreciation for what this creation is.
Yeah, and certainly that's true in marriage, right? It involves sacrifice and a lot of work, effort, make it work and take care of kids. And
oh yeah, and it reveals dimensions of ourselves that that just wouldn't come to light right. otherwise.
Right.
That is to say, if we just abstain from relationship.
Yeah, Genesis 1, in the first creation account, so God created man in his own image, in the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. Like the church fathers saw that, the individual image is God. We have a rational soul, intellect, and will. But the male and female as well together, right? The couple, the communion of persons, images God. Because he says, let us, make man in our image.
Yeah.
So it's a Trinitarian us there.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm inclined to think, I know there are some church fathers who have commented on this, that when you look at those first two passages, there's almost a repetition, right? So God made man in his image and likeness, number one. And then number two, it says, in the image of God, he created him. Mm-hmm. And you're like, why does he just say the same mm-hmm. thing again? But I think that second passage mm-hmm. is saying something like, after or according to the image of God, he created him. Mm-hmm. And who is the image of God? Well, most truly, it's Christ. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if that second line is referring to the human as made after the manner of Christ, and that would open up the dimension of Christ and the church, which is, what St. Paul says, man and woman are a sign of.
Hmm. Yeah. That's a beautiful way to look at it too, not just some like separate natural creation, and then you got Jesus or something later, maybe. But it's all going to Christ from the very beginning, right? That's the goal, the destiny.
Yeah.
That the fullness, that these are images of that, and it's fulfilled in the marriage of the Lamb at the end of time. But
I don't know if you've spoken with or know of Professor Deborah Savage.
I read some of her stuff, yeah.
Yeah, she's got some really neat things to say on Genesis and man and woman.
Yeah. Does she work? She teaches it up in Minnesota or something? Or?
She was at the seminary connected with the University of St. Thomas up there, but now she's at Franciscan.
Oh, wow, okay. So you write, too, in your book about the knowledge that a woman has of a man and a man has of, I remember Hildebrand talked about that too, that like they could, like the opposite sex could know us in a special way, or know masculinity, in a special way. That, I mean, I've experienced that, sometimes it's like we appreciate some things about women that sometimes they don't realize, themselves. And can you talk about that? I thought that's a great point.
Yeah, so I guess one of the things I was trying to highlight there is that in the marital relationship, there's a way in which each person becomes more fully themselves, precisely insofar as the other affirms them. And by affirming, I don't even mean something like, hey, you know, you're a great person or I love you. But even something as fundamental as the recognition of and choosing of the other as the other sex, right? Mm-hmm. And that there's something that each of us lacks.
Yeah.
That can only be provided for by the other in right. terms of our somatic constitution.
Yeah.
And so being appreciated as fulfilling the other in some way adds to our existence.
Yeah.
Right? But it's a kind of gratuitous fulfillment because we don't need each other in the way that we all need food or water. This is a freely chosen thing. We enter into it of our own accord,
yeah.
or we ought to. And everyone recognizes that because everyone knows that a forced sexual encounter is something wrong, mm-hmm. Or an immature one is something wrong. Yeah. And so it's a gratuitous kind of affirmation that we receive here. It really is a gift.
Yeah. And I don't know if you write about it in the Revelations section, but just the notion of it being fulfilled in heaven, that helped me, like in my own celibacy vows and things, is to think, okay, well, there's no giving and taking of marriage in heaven. So if this life isn't fulfilling, eternity is going to be a very long time. Right? So there, you know, the celibate's trying to embrace that marriage now. It's a gift given to some, you know, rooted in baptism, but have you written, or is that addressed in the book about the fulfillment of heaven of the male and female?
I don't know that there's much said explicitly about that. But one point that's made really nicely in that theological chapter is that the man-woman relationship is the primary sign, the primary indication we have at the natural level of the fact that we are fulfilled in self-transcendence, yeah. and in a self-transcending relation with an other, one who really is other in some determinative manner, yeah. decisive manner. And of course, that's the nature of our relationship with God, right? He is the transcendent one, and we can't find ourselves except in him. But the point this author, Dr. Welch, is making is that the first sort of indication we have that therein lies our fulfillment is in the man-woman relationship. What's striking is that doesn't even have to be entered into. It just needs to be realized and appreciated. Because like yourself, for instance, well, you didn't enter into that. But it's something that it's a reality that was a part of your development, right? And
right.
that you became aware of, that you're struck by, that you appreciate in some manner, and that the way of celibacy somehow has to be like that, or to include a dimension like that within it,
mm-hmm.
In order for it to be A, fulfilling, and even B, a higher way.
Right.
And that's something that John Paul II talks quite a bit about in the later parts of the theology of the body.
Yeah, because it's like everybody looks at marriage and say, it's this relationship of deep love, right? That you choose, and this person, you love them. And so that's what people most people on the street would say that, right? That it's about love, right? And so that speaks volumes to us, you know, that, yeah, John Paul, I think, calls it the primordial sacrament, right? This mm-hmm. fundamental basis that marriage is instituted by God, created by God, which is always interesting to me, too. You know, some of the church is so careful with that, that it's not, you know, it comes from the hands of the Creator himself. It's not something men came up with. So it's intended. And so it's this call to love. It's a call to be procreative. And so we mentioned this on the show, but just being that fundamental sacrament or image of God working, that he is giving us life, that you know, his relationship with us is a gift of divine life, like marriage is procreative. And it's certainly our relationship with God is one of love and a bond and a union. And maybe that's, I always seem like come to that, just that one flesh union, that's what we're called to, and that bridal spousal imagery that even is in the Old Testament fulfilled in the New.
Yeah. And that's been really striking to me for a number of years, how the scriptures themselves begin with the man-woman relationship, ends with the wedding feast
yeah.
of the Lamb.
Yeah.
You have the travails of the, what you might call the marital relationship of God and his people in the Old Testament, the Song of Songs and so on. It's very interesting, too, that in the Gospels, Christ, as we know, many times refers to, addresses another person as woman, right? He never does that to any male. He never addresses a male and says man.
Yeah.
And that's a very interesting linguistic detail to me, that it signifies that for Christ, woman is an important reality in his field of vision. Woman is a certain kind of other, even for him.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's ultimately meant to be understood in light of his relationship with the church.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I never thought of that. I never heard that even said. But I keep coming back to that as well today. You know, I think modern women, some are really, you know, I say, okay, we can't be priests. Well, what are we supposed to do? What's our role, type of thing, you know? And I think part of that, maybe, I don't know, for me, it seems like the part, your special vocation in the church to me is like to witness as bride, to show holiness, to show transformation. You know, John Paul II spoke about women, you know, modeling the loftiest of virtues, you know. And I mean, I could say that, I joke that I went to engineering school, you know, I go to seminary, work in the engineering field, then go to seminary. Now I'm in a friary. I've lived, studied with men my whole life. Women are the finer sex, you know. It's like there's a greater refinement, nobility there, I think. But yeah, that model of holiness. I mean, that's so important that we see that. You know, otherwise, the world gets coarse and cold and harsh.
That's so true. Two books come to mind in that regard. One is it called The Power of Silence by Cardinal Seurat?
Yeah.
I think there's a lot in there that dovetails with what you're saying, mm-hmm. that the realm of, I mean, in this context, the realm of the family, the domestic church that grows within that, the holiness that's achieved in everyday life, mm-hmm. all of that, it speaks to a certain kind of silence through which the Spirit is working. And second, the second book, it's a fascinating book called The Flight from Woman by Carl Stern. He was a psychologist, I believe a German immigrant. He wrote in the 60s. And the thesis of the book is that the Western world, the contemporary Western world, is dominated by a certain kind of rationality that he refers to as it's sort of hyper masculine, right? Dominated by calculation, mathematical reckoning, experiment, prediction, right? Mm-hmm. The scientific outlook.
Right.
And that we desperately need a reaffirmation, a re-embracing of what he again calls a feminine mode of rationality. And so that leads him to look at the masculine and the feminine, and what's the feminine, but it's the feminine is that which quite literally is able to hold the person within herself. And so her way of attending to reality is so intimate, right? So personal, so holistic. and so you might call it a more poetic mode of rationality in that way. It's more
person-centered.
Person-centered, immediately present.
Yeah.
So whereas the hyper-masculine form of rationality tends toward excessive abstraction.
Yeah.
And a distancing from reality.
Yeah.
And it's not that we should simply have one or the other, right? It's that both are crucial.
Yeah.
He makes a really interesting point too about the word genius in there, that it comes from genos, birth.
Mm.
And so what a woman is capable of doing in giving birth is something on the one hand entirely every day, but on the other hand, just monumentally amazing,
yeah.
right? That she gives rise to a human person
yeah.
from within herself. And that the modes of genius that we typically think about are usually more masculine, right? The great mm-hmm. painter, the great musician. And those are their ways of approximating what she's capable of doing in her very organism.
yeah. Is it a Jenny tomb, they call it? Yeah, like begotten, not made. I forgot there's some term in the creed, I think.
Oh,
Jenny tomb, non fuck tomb.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It's like, yeah. So men are, they're makers, and they fashion things, make things, but yeah, an organic life, birth kind of thing is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like art is like trying to capture glimpses of that greatness. I mean, a living organism compared to static art, you know. But
yeah.
Didn't Edith Stein said that too? Like a woman's soul is made to like accommodate or give room for the other. Like she's designed for that, you know.
And yes. Yeah, the personal is the prerogative of the woman. And in a certain way, Stein says, the emotional, which can be misread and make people wary that, you know, that she's saying something like women aren't rational,
right?
But that she's not saying that. She's getting at the fact that the proximity of reason and the emotions is kind of striking in the case of woman.
Yeah.
Whereas in man, they tend to be perhaps more separate from each other.
Kind of more harmonious than the woman. That, well, again, like a great Dietrich von Hildebrand theme. He talked about that response to value, that the highest perfection of it is not just like this intellectual appreciation or apprehension, but it, like accommodated with the right emotions. You're stirred, you're moved, you know, you rejoice, you weep. You know, some things call for tears, and that women are more integrated in that way. But too, I'm thinking like so much of social doctrine, you hear like the popes are basically calling for that to make it a more humane culture, a civilization of love that makes room for the least, you know, that people aren't cast aside. And so women would have a role to play in that. And
but it takes cultural conceptions, cultural images of women that are not just male-like.
Yeah.
Right. So just as an example, think of the number of films, blockbuster films, featuring feminine heroines that are heroines precisely after the model of a traditionally male hero.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, it's fun. It's fine. But it's leaving out something that's so important.
I know, something to me just seems impoverished, unimaginative about it. You just feel like they're trying to, just this imitation that a woman can never be a man, so it's just always going to fall short, and let alone believing that she can beat up all these guys, whatever, you know, it's just, I don't know, it just seems tedious after a while.
Yeah.
But it seems like, I mean, this history bears this out, that like you push God aside, and it seems like women and children are the first to suffer. Like the sexual revolution, women are like suffering with every advance of this. You know, the less we have a marriage culture, you know, the abortion stuff tears women up, the promiscuity tears their hearts up, and all this stuff. But even I was struck by missionaries. One time we interviewed on Life on the Rock, and they were in South America, they were high in the Andes Mountains, and they were working with some tribes, I don't know if you call them, but people that they weren't Christian, and there was like a lot of sexual abuse and stuff towards children, and of course women, I'm sure. I heard the same, we talked to a missionary in Papua New Guinea, he talked about, I mean, I think the faith really came there in 1950 in a strong way, and what was going on before that, all these feminists that are condemning the church, they would not like that reality, you know, what's going on before Christianity. You know, Christianity pushed slavery off the European continent and stuff. So those are, Christianity, you know, speaks up for women in a way that the world is completely blind to and upholds their dignity. And
that's a really interesting point. Yeah. I wonder if any good historical study has been done on that.
Yeah.
That'd be so worthwhile. Yeah. Both the slavery, but also, yeah, the abuse.
Yeah. Yeah, it just seems like you always hear that. And I forgot the term for ancient Rome, that pater familius mm-hmm. or something. Like the father had the absolute right over the children. He could put the children to death, you know. And Christians came in and changed that, right?
Well, and even, you know, even as we look to some of the great Greek philosophers as progenitors of our own philosophical tradition, we see that in their milieu, in ancient Athens, you have both homosexuality and pederasty as fundamentally accepted practices.
Right. Yeah, there's this blindness with man. I mean, I just heard something De La Box says, and I cannot recall it, but it's like, you know, this image that we're just fine without God, you know, we're just, you know, okay, if you can find God, that's great, that'll bless you. No, it's like we're animals, right? without God to guide us and to be fulfilled in Him, it's like, it just goes so bad. And I think, too, getting back to that role of the woman, and Jesus using that terminology, you know, at Cana, at Calvary, you know, in the book of Revelation, they have the woman battling the dragon, that there's that fundamental Christian witness I think the woman is called to model. And especially we look to Mary. I mean, she's the first and greatest disciple. And she wasn't a priest. She was in Nazareth, you know, way up north from Jerusalem, had no power and authority, probably a young teenage girl. And she said, like you mentioned to me earlier, she said, let it be done to me according. That's the model. Not that I'm going to go do this for you, Christ. I'm going to take back this territory. It was like this surrender.
Yeah.
It was this first stance of contemplation, receptivity, and humility. And
yes, even to the point where at the end of Fides et Ratio, John Paul II, which, as you know, is it's an encyclical really on philosophy, on what philosophy is, how important it is to the human being, but thereby how important it is for the life of the church.
Yeah.
It's not the highest thing, mm-hmm. but it's important. And he proposes Mary at the end as a model of the philosopher because of that receptive, that fundamentally contemplative and receptive stance, receptivity yeah. toward reality.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like we have to preach this in some way that I don't know. 'Cause I feel like, you know, obviously men are floundering, but women too. And even sometimes in Catholic circles, sometimes I feel like, you know, they might see, and rightly so, I mean, Paul VI warned about this, you know, of just having antiquated forms of Marian devotion or something, or a view of Mary that's very culturally bound or something. And like modern women can't relate to her. And, but I, you know, I've had experience of her. I just remember I was praying, I was going through had a difficult thing I was facing, and I was praying, and so I was in this dark chapel, and the statue of Our Lady of Fatima, she all of a sudden, like, it seemed like her countenance just had a fierce kind of look about her that I think, I felt like she was telling me to, all right, this is a tough, but you got to be tough. Right. Mm-hmm. I'm used to the tender Mary. You know, when I went to Częstochowa and I went to that shrine, I felt the charism of that shrine to me was like, this people, the Polish people, have been just mowed over and attempted to eradicate. You know, they lost their borders like two or three times, you know, just overrun by countries, and they're holding on to the faith and their culture. And you know, the whole country would make these pilgrimages to Częstochowa, and I just felt it was like this place of strength.
Wow.
I just really, I prayed a rosary there with the group, those people always there praying in front of the image, and just strength.
That's a great insight. But it really does accord with, again, with what the reality of married and family life is like.
Yeah.
You think about, I think about my wife, just the day in and day out sacrifices,
right.
Kind of life of sacrifice that she's had to make with, you know, involving her attentiveness to the kids and giving up certain things and putting them first. And, you know, they're much better at dealing with sickness than we men are.
like the day-to-day routine. And that, to me, it's totally hidden.
Exactly.
Nobody gives them a medal.
Exactly.
Nobody recognizes anything.
Right. And we tend to be off at work.
Yeah.
That there's a toughness there that's extraordinary.
Well, in fact, I think Joseph Pieper, when he talks about fortitude, he talks about women as having a perfection of fortitude. If, like, part of the definition is that, like, this holding on to the good, the strength to hold on to the good. So yeah, there's this attack element that you're going to go without and attack or defend. But I think at the very core of it is just to hold on to the good. And you see that just preeminently in women.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
And that is a much more, that's a notion of fortitude that's much more adapted to the Christian life.
Yeah.
Right, like Aristotle focuses on the heroic,
uh-huh.
right? The chosen death in war, which is great, but as Christians, for most of us, that's very rare.
As you sit here with a tie, and
yeah, my sparkly water. So it's the dimension of fortitude that has to do with patience,
yeah,
endurance, forbearance, the. Even what we call meekness, but that holding on to the good, like you're saying. Yeah, that's really great.
But to talk about men on that flip side, though, it is a time, the intellectual side of trying to defend the faith. And I love the podcasts that are available now. You get some real intellectuals, people I've never heard of, like professors being interviewed about like this Richard DeClue. I just listened to him. He just wrote a book on Benedict, and he was talking about his theology of the history, and it was just so powerful and glorious. And that is part of, I think, the masculine genius, to go in and to systematize. Let's set up some categories here. Let's place this stuff here, you know, so we can understand this and come up with an intellectual defense, a reason for our faith, right? That is exciting, isn't it? You're at the heart of that, right? Is training young minds and stuff.
It's very exciting. And there's reason to think that it's going to be more prevalent and necessary now than ever, for two reasons. One of them is that we just have more information at our disposal than humans ever had.
Yeah.
Arguably too much information.
Yeah.
So the resources are there, but also the resources for many, many people to have bad opinions about things. But then secondly, this is maybe the first time in human history where at a societal level we're asking ourselves fundamental metaphysical questions like, what is a man? What is a woman?
Right.
What is it? What is human?
Yeah.
Right. What about AI? What about the singularity? These sorts of questions really call for the intellectual tradition,
yeah,
and a creative approach to it.
Yeah.
I've noticed recently that AI companies are reaching out to philosophers because they want them to train AI.
Hmm.
Because if you think about it, they're wanting AI to become self-aware, self-conscious.
Yeah.
And so that's the realm of philosophy, right? Of the most fundamental sorts of questions of what it is to be, who am I, and so on. And so I find it both terrifying but also hilarious that finally the big companies are reaching out to the philosophers for assistance.
So you guys are driving like exotic cars now?
Thomas Aquinas is fighting a different fight.
What is that, like, when you look at the cultural landscape, what are some of the most important things that we could say here? Like, some of the biggest errors of the day, you as a philosopher see that you keep tripping on, you see this being a stumbling block. Are there some things that are your kind of pet peeves that you or feel called to even talk about more?
That's a great question. One thing that comes to mind, and this is no surprise, it's been said by many, but the way in which we take certain scientific and technological models or modes of speech really as something like a dogma or a religion, mm-hmm, and proceed from that launching point as though we're all good and as though we're doing something eminently rational and argumentative, when in fact it's just an appeal to a bizarre sort of authority.
Mm.
So, just to give an example, I have no issue with the theory of evolution understood in certain ways, right? But when you hear over and over again explanations of who and what we are by having resort to what we apparently did 3 million years ago, and that being hardwired in us, and that just accounts for phenomena that we see around us every day,
mm,
seems to me that there's something backwards about that. Mm. Okay, it might be an interesting theory, but why don't we go from our holistic experience of what is in front of us here and now? We're human. Our friends are human. We can attend to ourselves and each other. We don't have to feel like, in order to make a claim about ourselves, that we need to invoke what apparently was the case in a much more primitive manner 3 million years ago. And there's something similar when it comes to the realm of computer technology. That we use the language of thinking. It knows. It wants to. So we've already sort of, in our own thought, we've kind of effectively already uploaded what it is to be us right. to the realm of
right.
the computer yeah. and regard it as something that's well on its way, but that we're also in awe of in a way that we're not in awe of ourselves.
Yeah.
And so those are two extremes, but both deficient ways of conceiving of what it is to be human. And so to me, that's a bad way to start thinking about things. And it should recall us to the classical tradition of philosophy, which involves starting with talking with other people and what do you think and how do things appear to you? And well, let's digest that and then start working more to the heart of things, to the heart of what's at the heart of our experience, and distilling that into certain yeah. fundamental principles and categories.
Yeah.
Now that's a very broad answer to your question, but I think it infects many, many modes of thought and speech and many areas of our life by extension.
What did they call that area in Athens, like where Socrates and or Plato and Aristotle walked, the Plaka or something? Raphael had a famous painting.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so we need space like that. You're saying to have like a conversation. And
and you see that starting to emerge, mm-hmm. you know, in things like podcasts and
yeah, it seems like the polarization and the politicization and I don't know, just the different ghettos on the internet, you know, that can form a fanaticism and stuff. It just seems like it's such a challenge. And
yeah, I think that also another thing, this is more a concern within Christian circles, but there still is a lack, I think, in many quarters of an appreciation for philosophy. Mm-hmm. And one way to see that is so many attempts that are made to sort of harmonize science and faith. It takes the form of, oh, hey, look, science says this over here, faith says that over there, and they're in agreement or they're not in contradiction. Mm-hmm. And on topic two, science says this, mm-hmm. faith says that, mm-hmm. and they're also in agreement. Mm-hmm. But if you leave it at that, you're sort of running along these parallel tracks,
right?
And there's no connection. Yeah. It's sort of just this happenstance selection of right. observations that seem like they're in agreement.
Yeah.
That's not an integrated view of reality.
Right.
And what philosophy is capable of doing is being the bridge between those two realms.
Yeah.
And we've got a lot of philosophical resources, but it so often it takes someone like a Joseph Pieper
yeah.
to be able to distill those traditions in light of contemporary questions
right.
and in a way that's readable by right. a typical person.
Yeah.
I mean, that takes a real, or C.S. Lewis is another one like that. I mean, it's a real genius in being able to do that.
I was interviewed. I just looked at this recently. I did a podcast years ago with Bishop James Connolly, who went to the Great Books Program of Kansas. And so they taught the Great Books education. They had some courses there, and a number of people converted to Catholicism. And I kept asking him, I said, I wanted to say it was just the material itself. And he wouldn't back off the point. He said, no, these teachers were especially gifted in doing what you just like talked about, Pieper, and making, helping people to get it, to understand it, and I don't know if you call it popularize it, but and that, I guess that seems like where the genius comes in, you know. I feel like I'm off. I mean, I just was reading some stuff what Ratzinger, Pope Benedict, said about faith and reason. Some of his audiences, and I feel like I was just swimming in these facts, and it was so hard just to bring it together, you know, to truly understand it. But he was so powerful. And he was talking about, and I always find this side interesting. To me, it's easy to see how reason needs faith. I mean, obviously, it gives us, you know, an understanding of God, and we can have communion with God through faith, hope, and love. But, you know, why does faith need reason to articulate that? And he was talking about the understanding, and it's just been there from the beginning, you know, to I don't know if the words is, he didn't use the word assimilate, but to me, it's like to give the obedience of faith, to give my whole person to God, it's going to involve my intellect and will. So that intellect seeks understanding of what this theology is teaching me, right?
Yeah, that's so true. And I think sometimes there can be this thought that because God has his plan, that we need to sort of jettison the faculties in us that are able to make plans,
right?
Which is our intellect and will.
Yeah.
And that's a wrong-headed way of looking at it for precisely the reason you're talking about, is that God wants us to give our whole selves, and we glorify him all the more in so doing. I like the reference you make to Bishop Conley and the program at Kansas U, and I am struck by the fact that, you know, I'm lucky to be able to work at a place myself at Thomas Aquinas College where discussion is part of the air there, right? The classes proceed through discussion, through seminar, and it starts to form the students in ways of approaching questions that where they see that there's an important reliance we have on each other to help us grow in truth, and that's a particular form of friendship that is so important, and that I think many people don't experience.
Yeah,
right? That friendship in the truth, with an eye to truth.
Yeah. Years ago, we went out and did a Life on the Rock episode at Wyoming Catholic College, and I've never been to Thomas Aquinas College, but I was so struck by the students. I mean, they just had a wonderful, they just seemed, I know I don't want to be Pollyannish, but it's like they just seemed healthier and just more vital. You know, they didn't have cell phones. I remember holding up my phone and waving it in front of one of the girls, and she said, "Ooh, shiny." She said, but they don't, and that just like friendship, I was just reading something that talked about, you know, to have friendship, the more virtue you have, the deeper friendship you can have. If you're trying to have a friendship with this super dysfunctional guy, it might be something we do in love and try to reach, but it's not going to be the communion if both have common values, especially, you know, Christianity, the right values and virtue and stuff, and you can grow close and share. And I learned so much just from like lay friends, just the way they say things sometimes, it'll just strike me in a new way. It's like the same truth, but they're putting it in their language or their experience. And it's like all of a sudden I feel like I understand it in a deeper way. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess in some way that's what a large part of the philosophic tradition is doing. It's not so much claiming to come up with new stuff as to rearticulate what's in some way already known, but in a manner that brings it into the light and makes it meaningful in light of a here and now circumstance.
Right. Well, I know you've had a long day. I probably should let you go.
Well, it's been great talking.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Finley. Thanks for coming to Life on the Rock.